This is John Williams. By the way, in the second half hour of the Business Lunch today, we'll visit again with Michael Edwards, the president and CEO of the Chicago Loop Alliance. I just think it's fascinating the numbers they're able to ascertain about how many people are downtown at certain locations and what that means. So what is the, for instance, the pedestrian traffic like in the city, and what does that tell you about business and tourism? They count bodies, and it's interesting to see how the numbers plummeted last year, and the graph is consistently going up this year. So where are we in the next half hour? Let's talk to Michael Miller now, Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University. Michael, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Good afternoon, John.
Another thing that we've been talking a lot about over the last year and a half is targeted unemployment insurance. That's been a great sort of study of unemployment insurance, I would say, in the last year and a half. What are you seeing and what are you concluding these days?
Yeah, as economists, of course, always want any fiscal policy to be targeted, temporary, and timely, to get it to the people when they need it, to get it to the people that need it, and then to withdraw it once the economy is growing again. And there was a lot of concern that the money was just being thrown out helter-skelter, and some of it was, of course. But some new research has just come out that shows the people at the bottom in what we would call the lowest two quintiles, the lower 40% of wage earners, did they have a positive effect from these relief from the unemployment comp? And the answer is yes. And so that's really good news. In other words, had those dollars not been there, the poverty among that group would have been much higher. It would have been much harder for them to pay their bills, to buy medicine and food and things like that. So it appears that the way that the government passed out the money was relatively effective at assisting those at the bottom.
I'm trying to think of how that happened. So that would have been stimulus checks. It would have been unemployment supplements and unemployment benefits. It maybe would have been rent forbearance, that sort of thing, huh?
All those. The study focused mainly on the unemployment compensation, the extra dollars, as well as the checks that everybody got under a certain income level. Yeah. And, of course, the people in that lower 40%, we do know that this particular recession was focused mainly upon that group. Normally, it would be focused upon manufacturing, where we know that in the pandemic effect, manufacturing kept going throughout the entire period, and employment in manufacturing was not dramatically affected at all. It was all in hospitality and leisure and so forth, where we have some of the lowest paid people, and those are the ones who did receive the relief, which is exactly what economists would want to have happen.
Did the rich get richer during the first year of the pandemic?
There would be some of it. Certainly when the Federal Reserve would lower interest rates, this could be good for the economy to keep it growing faster. It could be good for investments. You'll find that the stock market tends to go up when you have interest rates lower there, and the money is flowing quite freely. So, yes, there's no doubt that the rich did get richer, but the poor group did receive benefits. And we see now that the workers are actually having some ability to negotiate better pay. So finally, we see that the workers on the bottom are able to actually negotiate in employment, not just have to get the money from the government.
Well, that's an interesting point you bring up. Has the research made any conclusions about the wisdom of the unemployment supplements?
There's no final statement, and of course there never will be. In terms of the discipline, there will always be some different studies that come to different conclusions. So what I always do is I look at, in some sense, both sides of the coin. You know, certain groups, research groups like the Brookings Institute, somewhat left of center, and the AEI is right of center. And then you have academic economists, and I try to read all three to see what kind of work is being done. And I would guess that in 2 to 3 years, when lots of solid data have come in, we will have like kind of a final statement on whether or not things worked out the way they were supposed to. But it's now all pointing. I've not seen any research that points in the other direction. It's all now pointing to that it was a successful fiscal policy to help the people at the bottom.
Yeah, no argument here. Although I have I'm quite curious then what we will have learned about that unemployment supplement, and did that so discourage people from going back to work that they did not? The lack of employees these days, anecdotally, people will tell you as a result of too generous a fiscal policy. I'm not sure that that's the only reason that they're not going back.
I agree with you, and even though you and I are on opposite sides of the political spectrum, I'm thinking there definitely are anecdotes. I just have not seen what I would call reliable numbers that tell me that there was huge numbers of people above and beyond what you would normally have in terms of responding to unemployment compensation benefits. We've known for decades that unemployment compensation adds to unemployment rate, maybe a half a percent or so, because some people won't go back to work. They'll just take the dollars. But there's no evidence yet that I have seen that we got some extra kick in that it was much worse during this particular pandemic. And that's what we would want to know. Was the pandemic unusually bad in terms of this particular situation? And I won't, in a sense, take a position until I see the research.
Oh, I will. It's 1216 on It's 1216 on WGN. Stay right there, Michael Miller, economist over at DePaul University. We'll pick it up here in a minute. I wanted to ask him, and I will, about a hedge against inflation and where is consumer confidence these days. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. We do this Monday through Friday from noon to 1. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. Michael Miller from DePaul University's on the line. He's an economist over there, an associate professor of economics. So inflation, what's the number and what's the hedge against it, Michael?
Well, see, one thing about inflation is what we don't like about inflation is when we don't see it coming. If we know inflation's coming and we can build it into our expectations and into our wage demands, and businesses can understand it in terms of what they're going to be facing going forward, inflation is not so much a problem when it's predicted and understood. It's when it's completely a surprise that inflation hurts. And because of that, people like to find a hedge against inflation. Say, buy a commodity or some kind of an investment that will assure them that if inflation shows up, that this particular commodity will go up with inflation. It'll protect them against the effects of inflation. And for decades, and I used to think this myself, gold was always perceived as being a hedge against inflation. You buy it, and inflation is something you don't have to worry about in terms of your investment. A couple of researchers have looked at it, and if you look at it most notably over the past 20, 30, or 40 years, you'll find that there is essentially no strong correlation between the price of gold and inflation. It's not a hedge anymore. Maybe over a 100-year period is what the study said. But if you look at it over the short run, which is less than a year, or the medium run, which is less than 5 years to 1 year, there's just no guarantee that buying gold will give you a hedge any more than buying copper or any other particular commodity.
So then what am I going to do?
Of course, you should always have a diversified portfolio, right?
Yeah.
Stocks, bonds. And gold is in there, of course. Gold is part of a class of assets called commodities, and commodities will move up and down, and they should always be part of a good diversified portfolio. It's just that people tend to flock towards gold when they think things are uncertain with regard to inflation. And what this research shows is it's just simply not worked in the past 30 to 40 years. It's not going to be the hedge that people think it's going to be.
Well, I don't know if I'm describing a hedge, but for the last year and a half, money did well if it was in real estate, if you're lucky enough to have a house or more than one, and at least you had some equity there. And obviously, certain sectors of the markets did well. The technologies did really well. Cryptocurrencies crept up and surprised people, did really well. But I don't know if those are hedges against inflation, right?
No. And the thing is, one of the questions will be is, will price of gold jump at the same proportion as inflation is going up? You know, it's running at a 5.4% year-over-year rate. Is gold going to be doing that for me to protect me? And the answer comes down to no. You know, I even saw some research earlier that was asking whether or not cryptocurrencies or crypto securities are hedges against inflation. And then there's no evidence so far that they are. They're more speculative. They will go up and down much more than, say, the price of gold, or they will go up and down much more than the inflation rate. So
that's why I'm
there's
so
no hedging there either.
Michael, that's why I'm so confused by people that use it as currency, right? Because it's so volatile. I see it as an investment, not as a way to pay for gas.
That's correct. See, one thing that makes something a currency or a money is that it is generally accepted in exchange. And of course, crypto is accepted at certain places at certain times with a certain cost for the exchange. And until it will become much more common that it's accepted to go down and buy a gallon of gasoline or a gallon of milk, someday, if that ever happens, then we can say it's a currency. But to me, it's a speculative commodity at the moment.
What are you hearing about consumer confidence these days? And how important is that?
Well, I tell you that consumer confidence is one of these very interesting indicators for economists. If you look at only the consumer confidence, it will tell you things. It will, in other words, the fact that consumer confidence quite dramatically fell in the past month, based upon the fear of the various diseases that are happening and the increase and spike of the number of COVID variants and so forth, it fell dramatically. That, to an economist, is an important piece of information. What's interesting about it, though, is if you look at other underlying indicators, they will tell you roughly the same thing. So consumer confidence is where the consumer essentially digests all the news that they hear, and they come up with what they feel about how things are going now and where they're going in the future. And those feelings will tend to reflect what's happening. And it's this fear of the going forward as to, will there be more shutdowns? What's going to happen with school? What's happening in Europe? And you look at Australia, and so you look at the trade picture and so forth. Lots of fear. And that fear that you look at those other things is being reflected in consumer confidence.
I wonder what's more important.
There is,
Finish that thought, Michael. Keep going.
It's just that there is a pretty decent correlation between consumer confidence and the spending that people will do. So I would have a little bit of a concern that, you know, there's this pent-up demand that has existed for some time, that if people become fearful again, they're going to stop going to restaurants, they're going to stop going out and spending the way they did before. And this could slow down the economic growth. And that's why the Fed's going to have to be very careful going forward. You know, the economy seems to be booming, but there is, if this COVID problem continues and people become afraid, as is reflected in this consumer confidence number, then I think economic growth going forward will not be quite as strong as everybody thinks it's going to be.
Yeah, we talked to a bank president the other day who was very optimistic about people's readiness to spend money, and he was pointing to a whole host of things like supply chains being eased up and COVID being tackled and all of that money getting ready to be spent. So he thought the second half of the year was going to be almost explosive, but I guess if people get fearful, what are you going to do?
That's right. And that's what some of the research, especially in the midst of the pandemic, roughly 1 year ago, we couldn't quite figure out why the economy was as weak as it was. And it turned out that most of the research showed us it was underlying fear. People were simply afraid. And if this consumer confidence number is a reflection of how households are feeling, I think it's got to present some concern to policymakers to not pull back on stimulation at this particular time until they're absolutely sure the economy is going to have that future that the banker was talking about.
Always fascinating to visit with Michael Miller from DePaul, an associate professor of economics. Let's do it again soon, Michael. Thank you.
It'd be my pleasure, John. You take care.
On the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN, it's time to talk to Dennis Rodkin, the residential real estate reporter at Crain's, chicagobusiness.com. Hey, Dennis, welcome back. How are you today?
Great, John. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm going to guess you're going to tell me that the real estate market is cooling off a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question is it just August? Summer, August is always real slow in the real estate market, except for 2020, because things were just absolutely going crazy. I think we can probably expect to see it pick up again as it normally does. And the question is going to be whether it's as explosive as it was from last summer through really July of this year.
You know, now that you mention it, I don't know that I've thought about it in those terms. I've heard that it was cooling off and just assumed that that was because everybody that was going to go went. But maybe what we're seeing is just the normal summer cycle?
You know, I think we might be. I think there were a lot of people who were moving because interest rates were so low. Those aren't changing. There do seem to be some people who pulled out of the market because prices were rising so fast, and I don't know whether they will come rushing back in because prices are continuing to rise fast. So it's really going to be a question. So the question will be in the fall, do we get back to just a normal pace, or do we get back to that just absolute chaos that we were seeing in the spring?
And if that happens again, that would be after the first of the year, right?
I think it could be after Labor Day. I mean, look, you know, a lot of people moved because of the pandemic. I needed more rooms for an office or for a classroom or whatever it was. And then we began to get very hopeful this summer. But I don't know about you, but I don't feel very hopeful about the future of the pandemic right now. And so perhaps people who thought, we'll wait it out, now think, oh, heck, this looks like it might be the permanent state of things. And so they decide to move and get the, you know, we both need to work at home, we need a classroom for the kids, whatever it is. Maybe some of them get shaken into the market. I don't know. It's going to be very interesting to see.
Maybe there will be a second wave. What are you hearing then about residential or commercial space downtown?
My colleagues who cover commercial say that the commercial space downtown is really at a low. What they've been reporting recently is that State Street seems to be hanging on better than Michigan Avenue. A lot of big tenants leaving Michigan Avenue, but haven't yet left State Street. But on the housing side, we really started to see the downtown condo market rebound very solidly as the pandemic started to fade. It's not quite as much of a boom as I expected it would be, and I think that's partly because this sort of gray thinking crept back in because one of the reasons you would have been buying downtown is, oh, everything's going to reopen. We'll be going back to theaters and sports activities and sports events and restaurants. And now I think it looks as if some of those things might be delayed. So maybe there's not the same rush to buy downtown. So we saw a nice big surge in downtown buying, but it too has just kind of lost its edge. And I'm waiting to see what happens in the fall.
But Ed, that's an interesting barometer, isn't it, Dennis, about what the future of the downtown is and how we'd live in a city like Chicago if people are just waiting for the prices to go down a little bit but then are buying back in. It's they're investing. Granted, they've got a good price, but it's where you're going to live. It's they're investing in the future. They think that Chicago's going to come back, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think what a lot of people did was they waited because prices were so low. Or inventory was so high in the fall of 2020 that they figured, you know, I'm going to get in because prices are so low. And a lot of these buyers, especially in the high-end buildings, they're not necessarily buying to live, but to have a part-time residence downtown. And that would really be contingent on, can I go to the restaurants? Can I use the lakefront pass? Can I get into Soldier Field?
I think
almost nobody thinks downtown Chicago is going to die. The question is, should I put my money there now when I can't really use it, when I can't really use downtown Chicago?
That's a very fair consideration. You will need to be patient. The reason to buy a condo in the city is because of the city. And if the lakes were closed last year, the lake was closed last year, well, then how are you enjoying your 1,300 square feet, my friend? Can you tell me about the park?
Exactly.
Can you tell? But enough about me. Could you tell me about the Parkline building that you wrote about?
Yeah, that was an interesting. So that was a really interesting turn. That's about a half block west of Millennium Park on Randolph Street in the Loop, and it was going. They started in March of 2020, which unfortunately is also when the pandemic really started to hit. And they were going to be about 180 rentals and two dozen condos. The rentals were full by the end of July of this year. Nothing had sold in the condos. Mm. So what they did is they switched all the condos to rentals. It's a different class of rentals because what they were building as apartments were smaller, were up to about 2,000 square feet. And what they were building as condos started at about 4,000 square feet, I think is the figure. So these are going to be more luxurious apartments. But the idea was, here again, people were willing to make that temporary commitment. I'll rent downtown. But they weren't necessarily willing to make the permanent commitment and buy downtown. So Parkline said, well, then we'll turn those condos that we had into high-end rentals.
Boy, what do you get for rent on that then? That's a pretty nickel, isn't it? I mean, obviously somebody's willing to spend some money on rent, huh?
Yeah, they were starting at several thousand dollars. I don't have the story in front of me, but I think they were starting at $9,000. I think rentals were starting at $9,000. And you know, here again, if I'm an affluent person on the North Shore, Hinsdale, and I'm looking for an in-town, it may be possible to rent for the short term at that rate and not, you know, dump in a big investment of cash, a down payment. I can cover the monthly rent, but I don't need to put in cash into the building. And so if I decide, yeah, you know, we're just not using the restaurants, we're swimming at our public pool, or we're swimming at our home swimming pool in our backyard in Hinsdale, then I just get rid of the apartment.
Dennis Rodkin writes about residential real estate at Cranes. Hey, nice to hear you, Dennis. Let's talk again. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
See ya. As always, you betcha. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. We've got more business news now with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Cisco will relocate its Midwest regional hub to Chicago. The technology company will put its new offices in the old main post office space. It's moving to Chicago from Rosemont. Cisco will occupy just under 135,000 square feet at 433 West Van Buren. The space is being described as a collaboration experience center where employees will come together under a hybrid work model. Office vacancies in the suburbs rose to 26.1% at the end of June, and the Cisco departure from Rosemont adds to the decline. The Mag Mile could be transformed into an entertainment district of sorts. Ticketed entertainment concepts could replace empty spaces where retailers like Macy's, Crate and Barrel, and The Gap used to be. According to Cranes, producers of shows based on King Tut, Harry Potter, Dr. Seuss, and Pink Floyd are looking for space on North Michigan Avenue. Most are just considering the move at this point, but at least one exhibit is expected to open in the fall, The Office Experience, based on the popular TV show. It'll be in the former Forever 21 location at 540 North Michigan. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food and Steve Alexander.
Yes, sir. As we mentioned yesterday with our cooking tips from a pro chef, today's National Filet Mignon Day, and I posted on our website a mouth-watering photo of a ready-to-go filet mignon. It's beautiful. You can see that at WGNradio.com. And if you fancy a side of asparagus, you should listen to what Mr. Fizz, Jim Fizzell, has to say. And this tip is actually kind of mathy. With division and subtraction and addition, our gardening guru says this is the time of year to look at your asparagus patch. And if you're thinking of dividing the roots,
if it's to the point where you need to divide it, you probably need to go out and get new roots because they do get crowded. And once they get crowded, they don't have room for new shoots, which is what the asparagus comes from.
And here's another division assignment.
A lot of perennials have finished blooming, and some of these are ready to be divided. The first thing I think about when I think about dividing perennials is bulbs, particularly things like daffodils and tulips. If they get very crowded, they stop blooming, they make leaves and make a few flowers here and there, so you need to dig them up, separate the clumps, pick out the largest of the bulbs, replant them in full sun is best if you can do that. Do prepare the soil to a depth of maybe 6 inches before you do the planting. Add organic matter, any kind that you can get your hands on, that compost that you've been preparing all year, and plant the bulbs at 2 to 3 times the depth of the bulb itself. Irises and daylilies are done flowering, and it's time to dig them up. You want to dig the clumps up of those, divide them into sections with a fan of leaves on each, or maybe even more than a fan. Discard the rotten parts, particularly on the iris. So you pick those out before you plant the rhizomes back in the ground.
Mr. Fizz, another surprise from the USDA yesterday with the report on crop supplies and also the crop production estimates. And right now, soybeans are 22 cents higher. Corn was up earlier, right now down about a penny and a quarter. And wheat is trading about 13 and a half cents higher. Tomorrow's National Creamsicle Day and Sunday's National Lemon Meringue Pie Day. Have a great weekend. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Michael Edwards joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch, WGN Radio News at the top of the hour from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Michael's the president and CEO of the Chicago Loop Alliance. Michael, let's talk a little bit about some of the numbers you folks work with. Thanks for joining us again today.
Well, great to be here. Thank you.
We visited with one of your colleagues earlier this summer, and we were just talking about the number of people that come downtown, and you all track that pretty well, don't you?
We do. We've been doing it since July of 2020, and we just released our July numbers that I could share with you if you would like.
Yeah, by all means. So what kind of are we talking pedestrian traffic or automobile traffic? What are you looking at?
Well, we have a couple of different ways to gauge it. The one that is the most relevant would be pedestrian counts on State Street. We have actual counters on State Street that can measure things pretty accurately. And so July continued to see an increase in pedestrian traffic on State Street towards the end of the month, of course, with Lollapalooza and with our Sundays on State promotions that we've been doing throughout the month of July. We're at about 66% of our 2019 pedestrian volumes, which is terrific. On some of those Sundays, our goal was to beat 2019 numbers, so to have actually more people on State Street than we did pre-pandemic, and we've been able to hit those in all of our three July Sundays on State. Certainly Lollapalooza helps a lot, but it always helps a lot. It's the high point of pedestrian traffic on State Street each and every year.
State Street traffic this year was more than State Street traffic pre-pandemic, same weekends?
Pre-pandemic, on the Sundays that we were measuring for our Sundays on State, 70,000 people came to Sundays on State at some of our July activations. It's an amazing event.
Yeah.
And that was the whole purpose of it, was to get more people downtown. And, of course, we're getting reports from retailers of 20% increases in business, people shopping for different things than they do, a lot of kids shopping, back-to-school kind of things happening. You know, so maybe mom and dad and the kids come down, and mom and the kids do a little bit of shopping, and dad kind of takes some of the other kids over for an ice cream on State Street. So it's a nice time for people to be downtown and to reacquaint them with everything that's happening post-pandemic.
I'm really glad to hear that, although in 2019 you didn't close State Street, so maybe it was more amenable to foot traffic, but whatever it takes to get folks down on State. Although
exactly.
I wonder if we saw increased foot traffic then on Michigan or Columbus or some of the other streets in the downtown
area. I think we have. We have a couple of other counters, sort of a bit random, on Michigan Avenue up by the bridge before you go over the river. And
yeah,
we have one down on Michigan Avenue by the Art Institute. And those are busier than they've been. The Art Institute one, particularly largely because of the Obama portraits and before that the Monet exhibit, they've always been driving more traffic in that particular part of the loop because there's something people want to see.
Yeah, well, but, you know, listen, we've always got attractions to come into the city. Are you saying that in front of the Art Institute or over on the DuSable Bridge here, the Michigan Avenue Bridge, are you saying that levels are approaching 2019 for pedestrians in those spots?
Not quite. I mean, they're not. Yes, they are approaching, but it depends on the day, you know, to be not too complicated. It depends on the day, but generally speaking, we're about 66 to 70%, which is much better than a lot of cities around the country. But, you know, we compare with other cities that are around 45 to 50%. So we're doing pretty well. And, you know, people love downtown and they're coming down. 66. But we also track other data like office occupancy. And so we're not doing as well as some of the Texas cities, but we're doing better than many of the East and West Coast cities in terms of big city numbers. So we're at about 36%. Human occupancy, which is good. It's not great, but it's certainly better than the 5% we were at, you know, not that long ago, really.
Wow, 5% to 36%, still 36%. What would it have been in 2018 or 19? I presume the occupancy rate of offices in the city wouldn't be 36. It might be more like 80%, 90%?
Yeah, or more. I mean, it would be, you know, I would say it would be at 100%. We're comparing, people are comparing their buildings. Like, I have 100 employees in my building in 2019, and now I have 36 people in my building.
I see.
So this isn't square footage occupancy. It's like actual number of beings in the building. And that's kind of a different way to think about it. But we're getting better, and the buildings are becoming safer. People are, more aware of how to manage the pandemic. Certainly the variants are causing everybody a little bit of concern, and we do expect a bit of a slowdown on that rise in occupancy, but hopefully we'll get through that.
A lot of us are waiting for the kids to go back to school and see how that'll change
totally.
Everybody's behavior. Do you think the downtown will see a change as well as a result?
Yeah, I think whether the kids can go back to CPS, in a convenient way that families can be comfortable with their kids going to school, and so that people can come down and go to work. We do think people will return to the office if their life allows them to do that. It'll be hybrid. They'll be down most days. I think people will be in the office, but there will be some people working from home. In fact, I'm working from home today.
One last observation from you. What else should we know from your counters and your numbers, Michael?
Well, the hotels are doing better. Certainly Lollapalooza was a good bump for everybody. And we're just kind of hoping that the variant can be managed and that hotels can continue to increase. We have, if I could say something about Sundays on State, our next one is on the 22nd of August. And it's a great opportunity for people to, if nothing else, sit in the middle of State Street and have a drink, be with their loved ones, and just be part of the vibe that's down there. And we're getting 82% of folks would recommend that to their friends as an experience here in Chicago, and we encourage people to come down.
It's a Sundays on State, August 22nd for the next
one. That's the next one.
And the city's lovely all year long, especially this year, so I'll double that. Michael, thanks for your time. Congratulations. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Michael Edwards,
thank you, John.
Is the president and CEO of the Chicago Loop Alliance. You can find some of this information at loopchicago.com.